From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Violence against America in the Muslim world. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. U.S. Marines have arrived in Libya, and FBI agents are on their way in the aftermath of the armed attack that killed Ambassador Christopher Stevens. Libya has arrested four people and says others are under surveillance, but why did the attack occur where the U.S. is popular for liberating the country? In the meantime, protesters are outside embassies in Cairo and Yemen's capital Sana'a, and there's growing concern about protecting American personnel. Today we'll hear that anti-American anger goes well beyond spontaneous outrage over a crude and blasphemous film. On Reporter's Notebook later on, the latest on the producer of that film called Innocence of Muslims. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Tuesday, the U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens was killed by an armed mob in Libya. Today, protests continue at UPS outposts elsewhere in the Muslim world. We'll talk with reporters and diplomats and pollsters and others about anti-Americanism, its roots, and its consequences. On Reporter's Notebook, the producer of the film Innocence of Muslims is now reported to be a Coptic Christian. He first described himself as an Israeli-American Jew. First, this news update. The U.S. Embassy in Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, is described as an armed fortress inside several zones of protection. But protesters penetrated the boundaries today and attacked the building itself. P.J. Crowley is former Assistant Secretary of State in the Obama administration. He's now a professor at George Washington University. P.J. Crowley, good to have you back on our program.
A pleasure, Warren.
Describe, if you will, what we know so far about the situation in Yemen. According to the pictures, there's thousands of people in the streets right outside the embassy itself, breaking windows in cars and elsewhere, and some of them have actually climbed on top of the building.
There are, as you just said, multiple layers of security at a typical United States embassy, and certainly in Yemen, in Sana'a, which is a very challenging post and where we've seen violence and attacks before. Inside an embassy, you'll have diplomatic security, you'll have a Marine contingent, and then outside the fence, you'll have usually contract guards and then also host nation security. And any of those layers can be beefed up as necessary, as the president indicated in the last day or two as a result of what happened in Cairo and in Libya. Particularly for a post like Yemen, security has been beefed up, expecting that what started in Cairo would spread.
So you're not surprised then that the barriers have been penetrated and that the demonstrators have arrived at the embassy itself. Is it still secure?
I think the embassy is secure, and every ambassador with his or her chief security officer will make some adjustments. I think in the case of Sana'a, personnel have been largely moved out of the embassy and to a safer location. So these adjustments are made all the time. And just as an ambassador will look after the security of the U.S. personnel there, also has a responsibility to look after the security of any Americans who might be present either in the capital city or elsewhere in the country. So there's what's called a warden system to make sure that as there are changes in the security environment, those are communicated through a variety of means to American citizens in that particular country.
Are you worried about other outbreaks around the world?
Oh, absolutely. I think we're in the middle of this. Tomorrow in the Islamic world is a day of prayer, and after that I would expect we'll see perhaps the most significant round of demonstrations before this starts to cycle out. There's always a difficult calculation that you have to make. Attacks on embassies, tragically, is nothing new. We saw perhaps most dramatically the attacks on the embassies in East Africa in 1998, and we've improved security of embassies around the world since then. That said, there's always a cost and benefit to security. If you increase security, that interferes with your ability to do diplomacy. And for someone like Ambassador Chris Stevens in Cairo, or I'm sorry, in Libya, he understood this careful balance, and so you do what you can, but you can't ultimately eliminate all risk.
Did you know Ambassador Stevens?
I knew his predecessor, Gene Kretz, far better. I worked with him a great deal, not so much Chris Stevens.
Great loss, though, to the diplomatic corps of which you are or have been a member. Well, is this really all about this film, Innocence of Muslims?
I think from a regional standpoint, it appears to be, although in the case of Libya, it could be that what started as a peaceful protest was also a cover, for a planned armed assault. Clearly in Cairo, we haven't seen demonstrators with RPGs, but that was exactly the case, rocket-propelled grenades in Libya. So in a case like Libya, the difference is in Cairo there's a relatively soft landing in the transition that led to the departure of Hosni Mubarak. In Libya, it was a civil war that led to the departure of Muammar Gaddafi. Libya is awash with weapons, so every tribe, every political faction is heavily armed, and they're using those weapons to jockey for power in the new Libya.
But back to the video, which has been on the Internet, it would be pretty remarkable if all the people who are protesting had actually seen it. Are they being whipped up by religious leaders and others?
From my understanding, there could be multiple agendas on all sides of this, that some promoted the video in order to spark unrest, and then those, once the unrest has started, we've seen that spread from Cairo to Libya, now to Yemen, and undoubtedly to other places.
Again, P.J. Crowley is former Assistant Secretary of State. He was in the Obama administration in that position. He's now a professor at George Washington University. We're going to take a very brief break, and then we're going to continue this conversation with him and with others as well. Next, we'll go to Cairo, where David Kirkpatrick is bureau chief for The New York Times, familiar voice on our program. We'll talk to others as well as the day goes on. We'll be right back with To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. Once again, talking about the outbreak of anti-Americanism in Libya, in Cairo, in Yemen, and elsewhere. We've just been talking with P.J. Crowley, formerly with the State Department. David Kirkpatrick is Cairo Bureau Chief for The New York Times. And David, it's always good to have you on our program.
It's a great pleasure to be back.
I want to ask you a bit about what happened in Libya, but first, what is happening now in Cairo?
We have a kind of cycle of violence just for the sake of violence, is my position. I was just out there among the folks there, and they're still angry about the video, but there's a kind of familiar ritual aspect to this, where you have gangs of young men throwing rocks at police, the police firing back with tear gas, and it goes on and sort of perpetuates itself. Not a particularly ideological crowd, not a heavy Islamist presence, but they clashed through the night, and now it looks like they're going to keep going for another night, all ostensibly in anger over this pretty silly video.
What do you anticipate tomorrow after Friday prayers?
I don't know. I think there is likely to be some kind of a demonstration. I suspect that it will be much better controlled than this, and in fact, it may take some of the wind out of that. There was talk earlier in the week that the Muslim Brotherhood, the mainstream Islamist group here that put forward the candidate who's now the country's president, would be sponsoring that rally. And when they do a march or a rally, it's a pretty well-controlled thing. They're very well-organized and mature. They bring out their own people to guard the situation and keep everything under control. And if that's the case, I think it'll be a fairly peaceful and uneventful demonstration. But again, who knows? When people come out of mosques after Friday prayers, that's a classic time for gathering and demonstrations, as you know. So it's hard to predict here, and I think around the Islamic world. The one thing that is sort of funny and sad about all this is that, as I say, it began with a pretty stupid video, that was most insulting, I think, to its own maker. But each of these acts of violence and each of these demonstrations actually calls more attention to the underlying video around the world and brings more people into the street to try to protect the reputation of the Prophet Muhammad.
So the film then does play an important role, even among people who haven't seen it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Again, David Kirkpatrick is a bureau chief for the New York Times in Cairo. Very quickly, we heard a moment ago from P.J. Crowley about what happened in Libya, where there appears to have been a armed group with grenade launchers and other kinds of weapons ready to go. And did they appear to have used this as a trigger? And if so, what's the United States doing about it?
You know, we're working on that question as hard as we can right now. This group, the Ansar al-Sharia, the supporters of Islamic law, are not very willing to talk to the Western press. But to put it into perspective, you really need to understand the fabric of Benghazi today, of Benghazi, Libya. I mean, we're in that's a situation there where there is no police force, no army, not much of a central government. Lots of young men with Kalashnikovs, many with rocket propelled grenades, and brigades of these young men driving around with anti-aircraft guns mounted on the back of their pickup trucks. And these brigades, put together, you know, during the revolt against Colonel Gaddafi or afterwards, are basically law and order. But they not only are they a bit of a menace because they sometimes have fights with each other or do things that regular trained law enforcement wouldn't do, but they also protect institutions and sort of hold the place together. So they're a little bit of a double-edged sword. But understanding that and the role they play, for example, this group, Ansar al-Sharia, also protects and guards a local hospital that is their sort of base of operations. Understanding that role and their ubiquitousness and the ubiquitousness of weapons in Benghazi makes all of this, I think, a little bit more intelligible to a Westerner. It is not at all hard to get a gang of a few hundred young men with Kalashnikovs and rocket-propelled grenades and anti-aircraft guns out on the street to attack a consulate. In fact, it's hard to keep it from happening, almost. And it's also true that in recent memory in Benghazi, in 2006, you had a very similar series of events. That was when Colonel Gaddafi was in power. In 2006, a member of the Italian government appeared in public wearing a T-shirt that mocked the Prophet Muhammad. And so some young people in Benghazi took it upon themselves to burn down the Italian consulate in Benghazi. The Gaddafi police force fought back, and 10 people were killed in that. And when our reporter on the scene was trying to interview fighters at the attack, several of them brought that up right away. You know, it was almost axiomatic to them. You know, you offend the Prophet, we burn down the consulate. That's here we go again. And I can't believe these police are once again trying to get in our way. So I'm at this point, we don't know all the facts. But it isn't necessary to reach all the way to a sweeping theory about an al-Qaeda conspiracy to understand how this attack could have come together. In the context of Benghazi, you know, that it's quite easy to imagine. And you begin to wonder instead why the embassy or the diplomatic facility there wasn't better prepared for something like this.
Okay, David Kirkpatrick, once again, Cairo bureau chief for The New York Times. Many thanks for being with us. David Kirkpatrick, obviously trying to cover this story as we speak. The incidents in Egypt in particular have aroused concern about the relationship between our two countries, which, of course, has changed very quickly since the overturning of the former president, who was an ally of the United States, and the election of Mr. Morsi, who originally came from the Muslim Brotherhood, although he has resigned from that organization. Speaking on a Spanish television station yesterday, President Clinton was asked if, in fact, Egypt is still an American ally.
I don't think that we would consider them an ally, but we don't consider them an enemy. They are a new government that is trying to find its way.
Obviously, that is not President Clinton. That is President Obama. I misspoke a moment ago. And Nicholas Burns is now a professor of the practice of diplomacy and international politics at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He was Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in the Bush administration. He's also been ambassador to NATO and to Greece. Ambassador Burns, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
What about relations with Egypt right now? And does what the president just said illustrate how rapidly they're changing?
Well, they're complicated. Obviously, Egypt is the keystone state of the Middle East, longtime friend of the United States, but our relationship's taken a big turn in the last 18 months. There's now a government in place, democratically elected, that doesn't exactly see eye to eye with the United States. I think we need to do a couple of things with the Morsi government. First is to press him, President Morsi, to stand up and do the right thing. He needs to oppose the people attacking our embassies. He needs to find them and prosecute them. And he needs to protect our embassy and our consulates. That's his obligation under the Vienna Convention, just as, you know, we protect the Egyptian embassy here in Washington, D.C. Second, we also need to stay calm. It's been a tragic week for the United States to lose four diplomats in one day. An outstanding ambassador in Chris Stevens is almost unprecedented. And so our Foreign Service has been deeply, deeply hurt, but they will stay focused. They'll be on point. And I say that because you saw in the comments of Governor Romney yesterday that partisan politics is creeping into this, more than creeping into this. And I think he made some wildly reckless charges against President Obama. This is too important a time with our embassies under siege for us to play partisan politics. And so I really think that everybody ought to just get behind the government. But it's complicated because we also have to play for the long term. It's in our interest to see democracy take root in Egypt. It's certainly in our interest to try to find a way to work with Mohamed Morsi and his cabinet. And I know there are calls in Congress to cut off aid to Egypt and cut off aid to Libya. We ought to let the dust settle. We ought to go back to those governments and try to figure out how we can protect our embassies, obviously, and our personnel, and then move forward in the very broad agenda we have. If we cut aid and walk away, we lose all influence at a historic time, a transformational time for the Arabs in the Middle East.
Egypt is the second largest recipient of American aid after Israel. Do you think there is sentiment in Congress now for changing that because of what's going on in the past few days and because of the change there in the administration?
I did spend some time. I was in Washington yesterday. There were calls in Congress to introduce bills that would cut off aid to Libya and Egypt. Now, the Libyan president spoke out quite forthrightly, apologized for what had happened in Benghazi on behalf of the Libyan people. And you know that the Libyan people, in polls consistently over the last few months, have been very very open to working with the United States. Egypt's a more complicated, complex place, but then again, we have a lot of friends there. And I think under the leadership of a really outstanding American ambassador in Cairo, Ann Patterson, we've been able to establish a good working relationship with the Morsi government. I know President Obama has a good working relationship with him. So I think it'd be a big mistake for us to react precipitously and to cut off aid at a time when we've really got to learn to work out our relations with these governments.
Do we have to stop for a moment and consider the political implications of what you just said about Governor Romney? You were in the State Department. You were Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in the Bush administration. He is, of course, running for the Republican nomination for president. You said his charges were reckless. And what were they? In what way were they reckless? And what damage do you think they might have done?
Well, I was a career diplomat for a long time. I served in both Republican and Democratic administrations. Okay. I'm not a political person. But as I looked at what happened, Governor Romney charged that President Obama was sympathizing with the terrorists who attacked our embassy in Cairo and apologizing for the United States. I looked very carefully at President Obama's statement. He did no such thing. I watched Secretary Clinton's statement. She did no such thing. They condemned the terrorism. They said there was no excuse for it. They were very strong, forceful statements. I frankly think the Romney campaign, unfortunately, leapt into this, seeing some kind of political angle, I guess, before they knew what was really happening, before they knew what was going to happen in Benghazi, and then they didn't pull back and retract their statements and apologize. They just doubled down and made a second statement, but it is completely inaccurate to say that President Obama apologized and sympathized with the terrorists. In fact, it's quite the reverse. And I just think at a moment when you have, and I was in a TV studio this morning watching our embassies being besieged in Yemen and in Egypt, when you have this extraordinary situation, our diplomats need support, not just from the federal government, but from the opposition party, the Republican Party. And all of us ought to get behind them and then argue politics separately here at home.
Nicholas Burns, again, was in the State Department during the Bush administration, but as he indicated, he's a career diplomat and has served under many presidents from different parties. Still with us, P.J. Crowley, former Assistant Secretary of State during the Obama administration, and now a professor at George Washington University. Do you agree that partisan politics is inappropriate under these circumstances? I know that it's being reported in some places, or the question is being raised. Is this comparable to what happened in the last days of Jimmy Carter's administration when protesters took over the American embassy in Tehran, Iran?
I agree with Nick, and I don't know that this is going to have international significance. And in terms of damage, it may well be Mr. Romney has primarily done damage to himself. I think that to add to what Nick just said about diplomats needing support, what made me uncomfortable was he probably should have just called a timeout and said, you know, today is not the day to get jumped back into politics. I'm going to give it a little time. He might have put himself in a better position had he taken a pause rather than taking a leap. But the statements that he found objectionable actually came not initially from the president or the secretary, but from some of our diplomats overseas in some of these embassies that are under siege. They represent the United States. They don't represent the president. They do represent the president, but they also represent the American people. And just as we would be hesitant to criticize an individual soldier on a battlefield, I found it discomforting that we end up pointing political fingers at people, foreign service officers who are just trying to find ways, to serve the national interest in these difficult posts.
And Nicholas Burns, I know you only have a minute or so left to be with us. What do you anticipate tomorrow? We heard earlier from P.J. Crowley and David Kirkpatrick of The Times was a little bit uncertain. But do you think that in the aftermath of Friday prayers, we're going to see more anti-American demonstrations in more places? And if so, where?
Well, you know, I think what we're seeing here, and David Ignatius of The Washington Post had a very, very good column on this morning, and people should read it. We're seeing really struggles within these Arab countries for the future of these countries. You have moderate governments in Egypt, in Yemen, in Libya, and they're being assaulted from within by these extreme Islamic movements. That's exactly what's been happening in each of the three countries. And so we've got to help these governments win that battle politically and otherwise. And obviously tomorrow is an important day because traditionally people go to mosque and they come out of the mosque and if they're urged to take the road to violence, they may do so. I've got to believe, and I know that the administration is doing everything it can to work with these governments to protect our embassies and our consulates. Our diplomats are on the front line, and PJ, I couldn't agree more with PJ about the fact that we need to stand up for them. And that statement made by the American Embassy in Cairo that Governor Romney criticized, that statement was made in anticipation of a riot and demonstration against the embassy. And it simply said, we, the U.S. government, don't agree with a hateful video produced in our country, which disparaged the Prophet Muhammad.
Okay.
I thought they were right to issue that statement.
All right. We're going to talk more about that video later on our program. In the meantime, Nicholas Burns, I know you need to leave us. Again, formerly Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in the Bush administration. Thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you very much.
We're going to continue in a moment with P.J. Crowley and others on To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, once again talking about anti-Americanism in the Muslim world and the various outbreaks that we are seeing this week, what might happen tomorrow. Muhammad Yunus is a senior analyst at Gallup Polls. He focuses on Muslim public opinion. It's good to have you back on our program.
Great to be here.
Tell us a little bit more, if you will, about Libya. We had an extraordinary statement by the Secretary of State yesterday where she said, how is it that in a country that we liberated, in a city that we saved from destruction, there would be this kind of an attack not only on an American outpost, but on a man, Ambassador Christopher Stevens, who had been doing so much to try to help the new democratic regime in that country get underway. What is the attitude toward America in Libya?
Well, I'm great. I'm really happy that you asked that question because the attitude towards the U.S. and Libya really stands apart from everything that we've seen really in the history of public opinion polling in the region. So currently, U.S. approval, or at least back in April, it was at just about 50% in Libya. That's Libyans approving of U.S. leadership's performance. Just to sort of give you a point of reference, U.S. approval in Egypt currently is at about 16%. And that's a lot more like what we see across the wider MENA region. So Libya is a place, or these unfortunate events happen at a time in Libya where U.S. approval was actually the highest it's ever been, not only in Libya but in the region. Overwhelming support for the NATO intervention that led to Gaddafi's departure from power. And also unique to Libya is an interest and a need in seeing the West play a role in sort of the professional development of the military capabilities of the Libyan state. So when we ask about the kinds of things that Western governments should cooperate with Libya on, very little appetite for sort of funding political groups, a la what we saw happen in Egypt with some NGOs there, but a huge interest in seeing the U.S. share some of its military technological expertise and training and equipment for Libyan forces themselves. But what happened in Libya yesterday had very little to do, I think, and particularly the aspect of what happened that had to do with the loss of life on the part of U.S. Foreign Service officers had a lot less to do with sort of general public opinion. It had more to do with the security situation in the country that has been a major challenge for the government of Libya. And I think will continue to be so as long as we see the country basically awash with very heavily armed militias.
Mohammed Yunus again, senior analyst at Gallup Polls. Ronald Bruce St. John is author of a number of books about Libya, including his latest, Libya From Colony to Revolution. Mr. St. John, good to have you on our program.
Good to be back.
Obviously, there are people, units in Libya, and we heard earlier about all of the various militias and how well-armed they are, that are not favorably inclined toward the United States. Who do you think it is that's most likely to have been behind the armed attack on the consulate this week, which had such catastrophic results?
Well, I think it's impossible to say at this point exactly which group. But it's very likely that it was an ultra-conservative Muslim group, often collectively called Salafis, from eastern Libya. Eastern Libya has long been an area of a center of conservative Islam. And if you go back to the Iraq War and the U.S. participation in the invasion and occupation of Iraq, after the U.S. Occupied Iraq, the second largest contingent of foreign fighters opposing the United States in Iraq were Libyans, most of which came from eastern Libya. The largest contingent was from Saudi Arabia, but if you looked at it on a per capita basis, the largest contingent was from Libya. So this has been an area of conservative Islam and conservative thinking for a long period of time. Since the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime, we've seen a number of conservative Islamist groups formed there, one of which has been talked about in the last couple of days, Ansar al-Sharia, which is based in Benghazi and farther east in Dara or Darna. And they have been suggested as one possible group. Another group that might actually be more likely to be behind this this attack on the U.S. consulate and the murder of four U.S. diplomats is Ammar Abdul Rahman Brigade. That's a group which has claimed responsibility earlier in the year for an attack on the U.S. consulate. They've also claimed responsibility for an attack on the International Red Cross, for attacks on various Sufi shrines and burial places, for an attack on World War II British cemetery in Libya and so forth. So the number of candidates or potential may in the end not be so important to identify one specific group as to better understand, this conservative element in eastern Libya, which is opposed to many things, Western and otherwise. But equally important, it's also important to emphasize that this is a very, very small minority of Libyans. And I would cite two examples there. If you look at the General National Congress elections, which were held in July of this year, only 17 out of the 80 seats available to political parties went to the Muslim Brotherhood. In turn, the Al-Asala Gathering, which is a Salafi conservative Muslim group, they won no seats. And we just had yesterday the selection of a prime minister. And again, we saw the Muslim Brotherhood being eliminated in the first round of voting, getting only 41 out of 200 ballots. So the point I'm trying to make is that it's difficult to say exactly who was behind this this attack. But one thing that is almost certain is that it was a very small minority of people involved in the attack and supportive of the attack.
Well, now the U.S. has said that working with the new Libyan government, it's going to try to, as the president put it, bring to justice those who killed Ambassador Stevens. Do you think they'll be able to do that, given the complexity of the situation and all of the hundreds of brigades, apparently, of people that are armed and running around, as we heard earlier, even with anti-aircraft weapons on the backs of their trucks? And if so, is that going to be a popular thing? Let me ask that of Muhammad Yunus of the Gallup polls.
Is what going to be a popular
the effort? The effort to bring to justice, as we say, which would, I assume, mean either try or eliminate the people held responsible.
Absolutely. I think that in Libya, certainly the efforts to do that would likely be supported. Obviously, there hasn't been a poll conducted on that issue, but based on all of the other data that we've gathered, the overwhelming majority of Libyans are interested in seeing Libya in a more secure, more stable state, and in a state where these kinds of attacks don't happen. Our previous guest just mentioned all of sort of the incidents of violence that we've seen from similar groups in Libya. We've also, one question that we have asked Libyans is whether or not they want militias to turn in their weapons to a central government, or in some cases, what has been proposed is sort of to be absorbed by the national army. And an overwhelming majority of Libyans, over 90% of Libyans, say that militias should turn in weapons to government force. So law and order is very much in high demand in Libya. We've already seen sort of, you know, other protests or vigils expressing dismay with the loss of American life that we saw there on the 11th. So I think those kinds of efforts probably would be very well-received in Libya.
Let me turn back to the film that has been used at least as an explanation for why there has been the kind of outrage there has, not just in Libya, obviously, but in other places as well. In Libya, of course, there seems to be a much more complicated situation. Here is what Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had to say about that and about U.S. involvement with it just this morning.
Let me state very clearly, and I hope it is obvious, that the United States government had absolutely nothing to do with this video. We absolutely reject its content and message.
Let me go back to P.J. Crowley, former Assistant Secretary of State in the Obama administration. We talked earlier about President Morsi of Egypt, who has said, as I understand it, that it's up to the United States to punish whoever it was that produced that film or that video. I would assume, given the freedom of speech tradition in the United States, we're not going to do that. What's going to be then the reaction, not just from President Morsi, but others around the Arab world, the Muslim world?
Well, that's the tension within the Islamic world, in particular within the Middle East and North Africa. You know, the United States response is important. I think you see the United States government cranking up its rhetoric regarding to disparage this film as well, you know, to try to deflect, you know, the attention that is on our embassies and the threat. You know, the government's getting blamed for something that private citizens have done. But this is really why the response in the region is going to be very telling as we go forward, because what you've seen since the so-called Arab Awakening. On the one hand, you see the emergence of governments in transition that are more representative, perhaps not yet necessarily in all respects democratic as we would know them,
And that's a good thing. But you still have a zero-sum mentality from a political standpoint, and there have been winners and losers in the Middle East, and there's been, you know, populist streaks that have led to, you know, clear indications of less tolerance, not more, as these things evolve. So, you know, the dilemma for a President Morsi, who obviously needs support from the West and international institutions to repair his economy, is how does he reach an accommodation, you know, with a modern secular world? As these countries become more connected to the internet, to social media, they're going to be exposed to things they don't like. And if every time there's a obscure video that emerges, someone resorts to violence, or a leader says, "Well, the United States should take care of this." Obviously, you know, we're going to struggle here. You know, Afghanistan in the last 24 hours disconnected itself from YouTube. Now that's a blunt instrument in terms of dealing with the media crisis at hand, but it's not really a sustainable strategy for the long term. So just as we have to understand the impact that some of these films have on Islamic public opinion, and we've ramped up our rhetoric against this film over the last 24 hours or so. Likewise, in the Islamic world, there has to be another way of protesting and offering opinions about these pictures, these words that they might feel are insulting, without resorting to political violence.
Mohammed Yunus, back to you with Gallup polls. If the United States doesn't punish, to use, I believe, President Morsi's term, the producer of the film, then how is that going to go down, do you think, in not just Libya and Egypt, but other parts of the Muslim world as well? Are they looking for the United States, which has denounced the film, to walk the walk as well as talk the talk?
Absolutely. That's such a crucial question. And in many ways, I agree with Mr. Crowley in the sense that it is the biggest catch-22 of this whole situation for the U.S. One thing to keep in mind is that, you know, Egyptians are now sitting in a country where what we've seen in the past 3 weeks are very prominent media figures, commentators, journalists, who are actually now facing lawsuits because they basically went over the line in their criticism of the head of state in Egypt. So the legal culture of many parts of the world, not just the Arab world, when it comes to freedom of speech and how government regulates that activity, is very different. This is coupled with a fundamental sort of distrust of the U.S., and this is another thing that we've seen in our data across the region. For example, when you ask people up through 2005 whether the U.S. supports democracy in your part of the world, an overwhelming majority of Egyptians and an overwhelming majority of Arabs across the region said that they did not agree with that statement. So there's a huge level of distrust, coupled with an understandable sort of, you know, missing of meeting of the minds on exactly what the U.S. government can do about free speech as expressed by a private citizen. On top of that, lay on instances where, for example, when we saw what happened in Afghanistan with U.S. Army personnel of the desecration of Qurans, the U.S. in that case was able to stand in, and the president himself was able to stand in and say, this will never happen again. The people that did this will be held accountable because it wasn't private activity. So to some degree, there definitely has to be a component of educating, for lack of a better word, of some of these societies on exactly what the U.S. does with free speech, what the government can do about it. It's certainly extremely important for the region to hear President Obama be very forceful in his condemnation of the content of the film itself, and we've seen that happen, and we'll continue to see that happen. We've also seen, though, on the other hand, a stronger language coming from President Morsi this morning specifically on protecting U.S. personnel on the ground and on protecting the embassies that are within Egyptian borders. So leaders on each part can sort of do their part or play their role in trying to bridge that gap of understanding between the two.
Okay.
But certainly, as long as this topic is sort of going to remain in the media frenzy, the anger will continue to grow, and I think tomorrow most of us are expecting to see pretty large protests in some of the major cities across the Arab world, if not beyond.
So, P.J. Crowley, back to you. The Arab Spring, so-called, has turned into something very different from what was anticipated, and it's going to be very difficult to deal with it. What about the patience of the American people for supporting governments that have to oversee the kinds of things that we are seeing this week, who in some cases themselves aren't fully understanding of, let alone supportive of, American ideas about free speech? Are we going to be able to continue to support these countries, and is it a good idea?
It is absolutely a good idea, but we have to have realistic expectations. You know, just like in this country, we talk about a more perfect union. You know, we didn't create democracy in 1776 and perfect it by 1777. You know, it's going to take time. There are going to be difficult processes. We're going to have good days and bad days. We've had some bad days over the past couple. You know, so but we have to know that we can guide. In some cases, we can help to shape. But we're not going to determine where this ends. Those decisions and those actions are going to happen in the region. And I think it's important for the United States to maintain its commitment to this region because it is important to us, and focus on interests, not necessarily personalities, which made the president's statement last night on Egypt, I think, a little bit remarkable. Because normally the U.S. interests supersede a particular government or even a particular action that we don't like. So I think as long as we focus on the long term and understand that there are going to be twists and turns along the way, it will ultimately serve U.S. interests.
Very quickly, Ronald Bruce St. John, if in fact the United States doesn't punish the makers of the film, which again one is hard pressed to think they will, what's likely to be the reaction from the extremist groups that you enumerated earlier, and will they use that as a way of attacking the United States?
Well, I think, first of all, it's going to be very difficult for the United States government to punish the people who put the film out. So I think you have to assume that's not going to happen. And as a result, we simply have a little steeper hill to climb in terms of working with broader-minded people in the Arab world, and particularly in this case in Libya, to help them better understand what the U.S. can and can't do in terms of restricting free speech in our own country, as we work with them to try to get them to better understand what their opportunities are for freedom of speech and the myriad of other freedoms that we enjoy here.
Okay, so P.J. Crowley, that would mean education, as we heard earlier from Muhammad Yunus, but also education of the American people, I assume, to be patient as these countries develop.
There are going to be populist policies in the region. We can't resort to populism here at home. You hear some of those voices, as Nick Burns was talking about, where because they don't agree with us, because they're not doing exactly what we want, we should cut aid. We actually the opposite. We should show our long-term investment, do the things that, as Muhammad Yunus was talking about, the things that the people want and are valuable to them, demonstrate our commitment over time, and that will maximize the influence that we have. One of the reasons why Hillary Clinton made her statements today criticizing the film is knowing that we are not going to prosecute the filmmaker because it's not clear that there's been a crime committed here. We have to give leaders in the region something to hang their hat on. They're going to hang their hat on the criticism that our leaders are saying about deploring this film and its message.
All right. P.J. Crowley, again, formerly with the State Department during the Obama administration, now at George Washington University. Many thanks to you, Ronald Bruce St. John. Libya, From Colony to Revolution, his latest book. Muhammad Yunus, senior analyst at the Gallup Polls, focusing on Muslim public opinion. Thanks to you all. Thanks to our other guests as well. That film that has caused so much trouble around the world is called Innocence of Muslims. It's crudely produced, full of blasphemy, hateful to Muslims. In a moment, we'll hear about the identity of the producer, Don To The Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_KCRW.
Well, we're not only back with Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. Here's more of what Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said today about that film, Innocence of Muslims.
This video is disgusting and reprehensible. It appears to have a deeply cynical purpose to denigrate a great religion and to provoke rage.
Again, Hillary Clinton speaking just this morning. Now, at first, the producer described himself as an Israeli-American citizen here in Southern California, said he had raised money from Jewish donors. Now it turns out he is somebody very different from that. Laura Rosen reports from Washington for AlMonitor.com, and good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
Who is this guy?
Well, there are a few people involved with the video, and they have gone to some lengths, as you mentioned, to be deceptive about their identity. There's an Egyptian-American felon named Nikula Baseli Nikula in your area of Los Angeles. He got out of prison in June 2011 for bank fraud, and they started filming in July 2011 another film. The actors now say they're going to sue him because they were deceived about what the film was that they were making.
Now, you say he's Egyptian-American. It's my understanding that rather than being an Israeli-American citizen, he is, in fact, a Coptic Christian, the Copts being an Egyptian group of Christians.
Yes, and one of the people who promoted the video, which, you know, very few people had actually seen, I think, when the demonstrations took place 2 days ago, is a Copt fanatic, anti-Islamic radical, and the mainstream Copts have gone out of their way to distance themselves from this person, Morris Sadek, and the film, and they've denounced the film. So these people don't represent most Egyptian Copts. It seems that there was an effort to portray the filmmaker under a pseudonym as Sam Basile, as Jewish and Israeli, in order to deflect blame from the Copts to living in Egypt.
Did the filmmakers appear to have wanted Jews to appear to have been the producers of this film?
Well, they're backing away from that now. But, you know, first of all, it was not clear. I went to the Israelis when the video emerged the other day, and, you know, they weren't sure what the guy's real name was. So it's hard for them to disown whether he's an Israeli citizen or not.
Yeah.
And so anyhow, there's another gentleman involved with the film named Steve Klein. He has apparently had a larger role in the film than he originally let on. He's has a group called Concerned Citizens for the First Amendment in California that protests against mosques in front of high schools. And it turns out that he wasn't just a consultant on the film. He actually wrote the script. He claims only to have met this Nakula guy for an hour or two, but he seems to have had a much larger role in the film.
So it's difficult, really, then, to know exactly who did what. What about the film itself? Have you seen it?
I've just seen some of the trailer on YouTube. I haven't seen the whole thing. It seems like the actors told Gawker that there was a casting call on Craigslist last July 2011, for another film, Desert Warriors. It was not anti-Islamic in any way, and then the offensive parts were dubbed in very crudely afterwards without their knowledge.
What about the statement by Steve Klein, the consultant, who you say may have written the ultimate script, saying that a lot of those people involved in the film were evangelicals?
The Gawker got a hold of the Craigslist casting call, and it didn't specify, any religion or whatever, so I don't know how broadly it went out.
One of the actresses was interviewed on CNN. I don't believe they described her as an evangelical, but she did say that she was terribly upset about the way that the film had ultimately been changed, distorted in her opinion, and that she had prayed very hard for the region involved. So everybody's religion seems to be playing a part in this.
Yes, and I think she also said she was going to sue the people behind it if she can identify them.
Is this any longer available on YouTube?
YouTube said that it's blocked it in Egypt, Libya, and I think Afghanistan has blocked YouTube there. So I don't know how widely available it is.
Okay, I don't know that we want to do an advertisement for it on our program, but Tell us a bit more about you're expert on the Middle East and a student of foreign policy as well. How did this come to be such a cause célèbre worldwide when it appears very few people ever saw it?
Well, it sounds like there were different things going on. There were already Salafi groups in Egypt, apparently back in late August, already planning for a demonstration in Cairo in front of the embassy. Terry Pastor in Florida, the radical anti-Islamic preacher, and this Coptic American guy named Morris Sadek both sort of fanned the incitement. But it seems like initially, at least, it was discussion groups, email discussion groups, internet discussion groups about the video that more offended people in the Middle East than actual, you know, people who saw the video. And I was at an Arab diplomat ambassador's up the street yesterday, and they also hadn't watched the video, but what they read about it upset them.
Okay. Laura Rosen, again, reporting from Washington on foreign policy and the Middle East for AlMonitor.com. Good to have you on our program. Thanks a lot for talking to
Thanks,
us.
Thanks, Warren.
Today's program produced by Katie Cooper, Sonia Geis, and Francis Anderton. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.